Radio Chelly Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Chelly.
March 16, 2023, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this is indeed the show you were looking for. Now, unusual, we haven't been live that much this week, but don't worry, that's about to change. So, anyway, in this particular Thursday night O'Chelly effect, it's a good thing. We got Michael Swanson, the author of The War State, also the author of Why the Vietnam War, a variety of other books, actually, as well. The guy behind WallStreetWindow.com. It's not just about Wall Street, although I fear we may have to discuss Wall Street today for a moment, or two, or ten. Anyway, in the first hour, and in the second hour, I have Larry Hancock and a special guest coming up who's going to go at something that you're very familiar with, but from a different angle, you the listener, of course. Anyway, we'll see how it all goes here on a Thursday, and we're going to get into some unusual people in the coming weeks, some people you've never heard from on this show before, although I'm really, really grateful for the repeat guests and repeat co-hosts that I have. Got to tell you, we're going to really change things up. We're going to mix a lot of things up in the coming weeks, so stick around, stay tuned for that. Anyway, be in the know, go to WallStreetWindow.com, and that is a good thing to do. We discussed local news a little bit last time, but we also got into some other subjects, Mike. Been a couple of weeks, though. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing good. Good to talk with you.
Always, always good to talk to you. Now, of course, I'm looking at banks. Now, I don't think of you as a banking guy, but, you know, you are somebody who is familiar with, well, financial media, finance in general. Okay. And I was thinking to myself, I wonder what Mike Swanson is going to have to say about, well, what are we dealing with, right? Banks that are collapsing, they made bad investments. Oh, wait, maybe that's something you know something about. I'm being facetious here, Mike. I'm sorry. But it's like, it was really interesting out of left field sort of story. The bank there, the Silicon Valley Bank, the SVB, right? Rather suddenly, well, they were going to remove the CEO, a few other people, because there were some bad investments, whatnot. There was a run on the bank. It seemed like the story came at us pretty quickly and kind of dominated the media cycle for a moment, even outside of the financial media, because people are afraid of what might be coming. But what did you see happening? I mean, where would you like to kick off the discussion on this?
Well, it is a remarkable in one sense, in one way, and that is how quickly this happened. Hmm. The stock market, it had a horrible year last year, but it had rallied from November till early February, and bank stocks as a whole were going up and doing just fine. This is not like 2008. I wasn't able to do the show last week because I got a colonoscopy Friday morning.
Okay.
And the Thursday, I couldn't eat anything, and I was using the bathroom, at the time of the show. I couldn't do it.
Well, they make you drink all that dye and crap, right? I mean, isn't that what they do? You have to drink.
But what happened was I went to the doctor, and I knew there's some bad things were going on a little bit Thursday in the stock market. What's funny is the Wednesday, the day before, the Federal Reserve chairman, or maybe it was Tuesday, but regardless, a few days before that Friday, the Federal Reserve chairman, he testified to Congress. And, we have this huge inflation that's been going on for well over a year. Right. The Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates to fight it. Historically, though, the Fed doesn't succeed in really defeating inflation on anything but a temporary basis unless it can get the Fed funds rate, the short-term interest rate that it controls, mm-hmm. above the annualized CPI rate. And that's at 6%, while interest rates are at 4 3/4%. Mm-hmm. And when he testified, therefore, he said that he was, the Fed was prepared to raise rates more and may do a 50-point hike next week. That's when their next meeting to decide these things are. They've been doing a couple quarter-point hikes since Thanksgiving. So increasing the pace of it in the perceptions of the financial markets and the financial media is more hawkish, more aggressive. And the stock market fell a little bit as a result, and gold did too on Tuesday, Wednesday, a little bit Thursday. And then, so the Friday morning, I will go to the doctor, and keep in mind, I had bought some U.S. stocks in January around New Year's, and I owned gold and silver and some other stuff. But I bought some U.S. stocks mm-hmm. for the first time in probably 2 years, I think, for U.S. stocks.
Right.
But they were coming down, and I don't like to hold things for losses. So I was thinking I might just sell these things. But anyway, I go to the doctor, and they, you know, they put you to sleep, and it kind of drugs you up. And I come home and turn on the television just to see what was happening. Right. And I saw the headline about the SVB bank failing on CNBC. I wasn't listening to what they're saying. And then I saw they showed price action of all these of the regional bank stocks, which are like local banks.
Right.
And they were crashing. They were crashing 20, 30, 40% in a single day. And these stocks have been going up.
Right. So let me ask you about this though, because this is the weird thing, right? You have the bank crashed for whatever reason. And I know if you're watching Fox News, it's because they were, you know, too invested in woke stuff. If you're watching.
Well, that's nonsense.
Okay. Well, either way, that was part of it, right? Some people said that they were trying to get in on the green technologies, and they were doing startups for that kind of thing, et cetera, which might be part of their business.
This is one of the terrible things about this.
Yeah.
You know, these banks crash on Friday mm-hmm. and it's, you know, people see that and they are like, they can get scared, obviously, you know, one is failing. And then over the weekend, you know, people say these things.
Right.
For their own agendas. This woke thing, you know, that's their agenda is hit on that issue. But they on social media, on the Twitter, on the Facebooks and elsewhere, there are people trying to scare people, telling them your bank's going to fail, take your money out and buy crypto and so forth.
Well, whatever, and because see, that's
those
my point.
People
the
are
reaction.
Doing people real disservice.
Well, but
and
thing,
they're
yeah.
peddling.
Right.
Stuff and really hurting people. You know, they're trying to create a scenario of true panic. But it's just crazy.
Well, okay. Here's the thing, right? It seems to me as though what happened, from what I can understand, because again, it was a quick time story, right? It just seemed to be emerging real fast. They had the CEO got on social media somewhere and made a statement to all the people working there and the stockholders and whatnot. Listen, I'm no longer in charge. He was removed right away, right? And all that happened. Look, as far as I could tell, what happened is they made some bad investments, and because they bet the wrong way on inflation, basically, they got called on it, right? I mean, that's what it looked like. But of course, but then there was a run on the bank, right? Because people started pulling their money out in real time. It was too much for the bank to hold up against all the withdrawals, right? So two things were going on at the same time. You know, inflation is something that's active on a daily basis. You got this other issue going on. And there was a run on the bank, literally, right? I mean, people were literally pulling their funds out. So, okay. Now, what do people think of when a bank fails? They figure, well, when one goes, more go. And then immediately another one went down, like within a couple of days, right? So you have that happening, and then you have the effect on the stock market where the market fell on, I think on Monday it was opening badly, right? Because they were bracing for problems to cascade here. And meanwhile, you have the Biden administration telling everybody, you know, calm down, don't worry, it's okay. And in fact, don't worry about the money, because even though it would be insured up to $150,000 normally, we're going to cover it up to $250,000. Or something like this, right? But only if they're like the innocent victims here. Something like this. I forget how they put it. But I mean, there was just this whole thing going on. And meanwhile, this has a wild resonant effect, not just on Wall Street, but then people are going to start behaving differently with the banks. And once that happens, that can cause a whole other problem on its own. Or am I reading this wrong? I mean, help me out here.
Well, there's a couple things. You're right. The problem is they see one bank fail, and then they do. People worry, and they see the stocks of these other banks crashing. Mm-hmm. So they wonder, are they next? And they're crashing for these things are happening for a reason people don't really understand, which I want to explain, but. First, I want to say that on Sunday, the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve, they created a temporary lending program. It lasts for 12 months. And as everyone should know, bank deposits are insured up to $250,000. Well, they said if there's any banks that have depositors that are pulling, you know, that you don't have really enough money to cover, you can borrow from us through this temporary lending program. You just put up some collateral, and the Fed will give banks now interest-free loans, which is pretty wild. I mean, they're doing this for all banks. I mean, it's never been done before, and that's what they're doing. But this is different than 2008, mm-hmm. and the banks this is happening for different reasons, and they're different types of banks.
Right.
So in 2008, I would just say watch this big short movie. It explains it very well. But what happened was these investment banks, mostly on Wall Street and giant bank, they're giants. They were buying these subprime mortgages that, because real estate prices fell in 2006, these subprime mortgages to risky lenders and so forth, they were worthless. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you know, 10% of the balance sheets of these banks were worth absolutely nothing. And they eventually, you know, fell into crisis. But
as with 2008, though, aren't we going to find in the next couple of weeks a bunch of things are probably going to come out that reveal a whole bunch of what were probably bad bets one way or another?
It's different. Yeah. It's the cause is different. So in 2008, it sounds like they made bad bets on mortgages, risky mortgages, and mm-hmm. you watch that movie, they make fun of the things the banks are buying, in fact. But in 2008, the local banks, the regional banks, were perfectly fine. They weren't impacted at all. In fact, an argument was made that just let Wall Street fail and your regional local bank that you probably, listener, probably banks at, they're fine. So let them fail. Let the big ones fail and the little guys will be all right. Now it's flipped. The exact opposite is what's happening. It's actually the banks that you would think are the safe ones. That, you know, they're just the local bank. You deposit your money in there, your paychecks, and you got a checking account. And what are they doing? They're mostly doing home mortgages. And maybe some loans to businesses, but they're not making risky financial bets. They're not betting on futures. They're not doing crazy things, but this is the time, they got in trouble, and their stocks crashed. So why, I want to explain why that happened. First of all, when there's a bear market like we've had or financial stress, there's a saying that it's like a tide coming in and you're looking at the ocean and you see these people in the ocean. And when the tide comes in, you find out, well, some of these people aren't wearing any clothes and they're exposed. Well, the tide has come in the market because of last year and the rise of interest rates. So what happened was, yeah, this SVB was a risky bank, in the way Eric's saying it, making risky investments, risky bets, so to speak. Yes, it was doing risk, and explain what specifically they were doing, but that's why they crashed first.
Mm-hmm.
And that sparked fear that, you know, who could be next. But I'm just saying the idea that local and regional banks are doing outrageous betting, I don't think that's true. They did come under pressure, though. But what the Silicon Valley Bank was doing is two things that wrecked it. The first thing is, I would say, unique to them. The other one is the problem that triggered their crisis and is hurt other banks and will continue to hurt them going forward, but not going to make them go bankrupt or something. So what the Silicon Valley Bank did, it was the biggest failure since 2008. I think it was like the 18th biggest bank in the whole country. And they're based in California.
Right.
In San Diego, I think it was, or San Francisco.
Okay.
But they specialized in giving loans to startups and these venture capital companies and technology companies. For instance, the company Stripe is one of their customers. And Stripe uses them to clear or has their transactions and, you know, has their money with them. But this bank was lending out to crypto companies that make no money, you know, meme companies that make no money, just promises that they got a concept.
Okay.
They want to spend $100 million on it, but they had no profit.
Well, Stripe.
And that's yeah. Very risky type of people to be lending money to.
Okay. Well, Stripe is sort of like a PayPal, right? Like you're talking about
that
Stripe.
That's right.
Which, you know, collects money and does online transactions, stuff like that. Which seems like a fairly solid thing to invest in because they're always going to collect their fees. They're going to have cash flow because they're constantly doing business. They're fairly well established. And you would think, okay, if you lend money to them, they're going to have working capital that keeps coming in so they can keep paying it back, right?
Yeah, they're fine.
Yeah, a company like that. But these other startups and technology companies, again, some of that might have been green technology stuff, especially in California, though, right?
Sure, that's true.
Yeah, okay. No, I'm just saying, you know, just trying to be fair about this. So, you know, and in California, there was a bunch of incentives for that kind of thing, as we well know. Elon Musk, right, benefits from having his
headquarters. Well, that's what's funny. These people that want to say this is a woke bank, they're the same people that worship Elon Musk. His company don't make any, you know, most of his Twitter doesn't make a profit, doesn't generate a profit.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, but that's the thing, is that he, see, again, though, he benefits from all this government interaction there in California, right? All the stuff, you know, he's making the electric cars, so there's a tax incentive there to do that. Stuff like that, right? So, I mean, there's a bunch of things going on here, is all I'm trying to say.
Yeah, you're right. But the thing is, this bank was lending to these people last year, the year before, and so forth. It's become a crisis now, and something happened to it.
Well, see,
is this
partially due to the fact that it's just kind of the inflation really coming due on all these places that had, you know, money floating around, and for a while they could absorb the higher rate of this and that and the third thing, but now because the inflation is you know, it's been swelling, and you and I have talked about this several times, the real inflation versus these numbers that they're giving us, right, where they're saying, well, things are up, you know, 20%, 30%, whatever. I would dare say that you have, you know, realistically, in day-to-day products, you've got at least a 75% increase in costs for most people. Now, that is not something that's going to go unchecked unless people's revenue goes up, right? So it's going to cause a problem. You're going to see a slowdown. People are going to afford less one way or another, even if they're affording it at a higher price, right? I mean, look, you go to the grocery store, maybe you buy less groceries, let's say. You're still going to spend $200 or whatever when you go, but you're going to come home with less. So you know what I mean? There's literally less transaction for the same buck that was there only a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. So eventually, that's got to work itself out when it comes to the money that was loaned out, right? Because it was worth more then than it is now. These companies that are supposed to be doing business to repay the loans, well, they can't possibly do business at the same rate if people have not had an increase in their incomes. I mean, am I reading this wrong?
Well, it is. The inflation is one of the causes of what happened to these banks. The way it impacts the banks is that, look, most people, almost everybody that's investing in the stock market lost money last year.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, if you go to an investment advisor, most of them tell you, put half your money in bonds because they're safe. That's your safety, they'll tell you, and half in stocks, that's safe too.
Okay.
Or that's your risk is what they'll tell you. Well, last year the bonds fell just as much as the stock market did, so they weren't safe. And what happens is bonds go up when interest rates go down in value. The bonds go up in value when interest rates go down. But when interest rates go up, bonds fall in value. And that's why, you know, people lost money in bonds last year. Well, these banks, all of them, own bonds. That's what's really on their balance sheets. They're mandated to own so many treasury bonds and so forth. And then when they do make a profit, you know, from your loan or your bank fees, they'll roll much of that money back into these different bonds they buy. Well, they were buying these bonds when interest rates were zero, and bonds, therefore, were at the highest value they've ever been, ever. And then when the interest rates started to go up, the bonds fell in value. Now, the inflation that you mentioned is what's making these bonds go up and down in value. The inflation goes up, you know, bonds fall in value because the Fed has to raise interest rates. So this bank here had $100 billion in assets on its balance sheet of these different bonds and loans and so forth 6 months ago.
Okay.
$100 billion. And that fell to under $80 billion rapidly.
So they lost 20%. Basically, of what their
balance
base was.
Sheet, okay. Yeah, exactly. Their balance sheet shrank by 80%, while the number of loans they're lending to people, you know, the debt they own, did not shrink. So that made them more risky financially. Okay. They're, you know, and then people figure that out, and they start withdrawing money, and then it became a cascade. Last week it says, I'm looking at this article about it. $42 billion was withdrawn, 5% at it. No, more. No, it's a crazy amount of money. $42 billion. I'm sorry. Was, 25 billion was withdrawn last year.
Okay.
And then in March, starting on March the 9th till last Friday, $42 billion was attempted to be withdrawn, you know, about half of all the assets. So it couldn't survive with withdrawals facing that. And much of that withdrawal was created by social media panic. People on Twitter talking about what they're doing to other, sharing emails, you know, these Silicon Valley people with each other, and they, you know, they crashed it.
Well, historically,
it's pretty crazy.
No, it's crazy, but historically, hasn't that been one of the ways that a bank has crashed is when you have a run on withdrawals, right? I mean,
oh, for sure.
You know,
for sure.
So what I'm saying is that,
in fact,
that in and of itself, even if there's nothing, let's just say, theoretically, even though, you know, I don't agree with this at all, but let's just say theoretically, there's nothing wrong with the bank at all. If a panic starts for whatever reason, and people start to withdraw way too much out of the bank, well, this could cause a bank to fail. Just in and of itself, the withdrawals, right?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, so, I mean, all right. So you got a 20%
in
loss.
In fact,
yeah.
Yeah, that's what the Fed was afraid was going to happen.
Right. Well, that's why they shut it down and then took it over. Right? I mean, that was the purpose of doing
that. Well, I
mean,
they were afraid that would spread to other banks that don't have the problems.
Well, yeah, because look, once somebody says, all right, that's a big establishment bank, it, you know, obviously it's known as the thing that lends to the tech companies, right? And tech is a huge part, a huge sector in the financial markets altogether, right? So if that's happening and people take it as, well, the tech sector is getting screwed because the Silicon Valley Bank, all right, which is a fairly large part of the tech sector, but not all of it, okay? If that thing is bad, well, maybe all this is bad. Now, this could cause them to start selling off stocks. It could cause them to start withdrawing out of their banks if they think, you know, that their bank has anything to do with the tech sector even, right? So you could have cascades that start on other banks, runs that start on other banks, excuse me, that could have a cascading effect and bust another bank even. Is that not theoretically possible, or am I imagining?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no. That's exactly the danger that developed because of the situation, and then that's why the Fed launched their temporary lending program to restore confidence.
Yeah, and then they sent Biden out to make the point that, don't worry, the taxpayers will not absorb this because, you know, we collect these fees all the time. Now, every time somebody tells me that, you know. I clinch up. As soon as they tell you you're not going to pay for something, I'm sorry. I say to myself, yeah, that's exactly the opposite of what's going to happen, even though theoretically they should have been collecting these fees and all this stuff all along, right? The insurance, if you will. They should have the ability to absorb maybe a couple of these. Obviously, if you have too many banks fail, there's no insurance in existence that'll cover it all. Okay, because then the insurance companies start going bust. Wait a minute, this sounds historically like something else that happened. or am I reading it wrong, Mike?
No, the Federal Reserve has they can make unlimited money.
Oh, yeah, well, that's the other thing. But if they keep printing money, you know, for just to fill these gaps, what happens to the money? It gets devalued, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay,
that's the cost.
And then what is the cost? We pay for it with even more rapid inflation, unless I'm wrong. And then you have the possibility, if enough of these banks go like this and they back up enough of them, don't we have the possibility of hyperinflation? Where, you know, yeah, you could be looking at a $20 loaf of bread quickly. I mean, or am I talking panicking? I mean, you know, just tell me. I mean, is it theoretically it seems possible. And this is exactly what people look to.
Yeah, theoretically, but I really think at this point, this is a crisis that's passing.
Okay.
I don't think this specific crisis, I don't think it's starting. I think it's passing.
Mm-hmm.
And the way things work, you know, with our news cycle, the 24/7 news cycle, next week they'll be talking about something else. And people will just forget because we're just, and though this is a huge thing, they'll just forget because they're just inundated nonstop, with this internet stream of news that never pauses.
Well, news cycle wise, Mike, I'm figuring that we should be done with it by, the end of tomorrow, because there'll be a new banner headline.
Probably.
There'll be a new marquee out there that is meant to get everybody's attention, whether it's a new prosecution.
Maybe there'll be a China balloon or something.
Something.
Or there was a drone, a Russian, a drone, American drone, right?
Right.
Maybe that's going to be something.
Right, the Russians took down an American drone. Maybe that's the thing that'll carry everybody through the weekend when the news cycle pauses during the weekend, even though it doesn't really pause. So your weekend story might be that this week. Or something else will emerge, brand new, right? Some new scandal, something. One way or another. But the news cycle and how it's going to affect the economy are two completely different things. Yeah. Yeah, I'm still here. You're not hearing me? Mike? Well, anyway, look, the news cycle is way different than the actual effect on the economy and what's going to happen with inflation. I mean, the fact that people won't be paying attention to it for a minute is one thing, but whether it's going to keep happening or not is yet another way I see it. But anyway, again,
yeah.
You know, maybe I could be wrong. I'll tell you what we'll do. Let's take a little break here. And I don't know if you want to continue talking about this or explaining it. I mean, I'm asking some silly questions here. I'm not trying to foment panic, by the way, or anything. I'm just trying to say that this is the premise, I think, that a lot of people were working off of when they started getting upset about this and started making other moves. And it might have caused them to withdraw money from other places. And here we go. Is this the looming crash that cascades from everywhere? I guess we all got to stay tuned and see what it is we can do in our own right. Anyway, I'll be back with Mike Swanson after a short break. Stick around. The Ocelli Effect continues after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold. Silver. The stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough.
Maybe you're thinking about getting started.
WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to the Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
Go ahead, Colin.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Nuclear Holocaust. You know what uranium is, right? This thing called uranium.
Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Get ready for the Ocelli Effect.
So far, bank crashes and other catastrophes we've covered with Mike Swanson, the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com. Of course, be in the know, go to WallStreetWindow.com. And it is about a lot more than just Wall Street, even though we've had to bring up Wall Street in this conversation today just a bit, but not too much even. Because what's going on with the banks? Are we heading toward a really, really bad time? I guess that's ultimately the question, Mike, because almost nobody is going to care unless your money was in the SVB. Do you care what happened over there? Probably not. And some people are celebrating it because, you know, the woke bank went down and whatever. But, okay. Let's get to it, though. What does this mean going forward? Is this going to have an effect on everything else? I mean, is it possible? Or are we looking at, because there was another bank crashed after. I don't even know the name of it because I'm still stuck on the Silicon Valley Bank. But what do you think is coming up with this? Are we looking at a time when people could react and cause a problem themselves? Or is it something that's, well, bound to happen because of the inflation and the rate changes with the Fed and the fact that they're raising rates? I mean, is it just inevitable that we're going to see some financial institutions fail? And, well, you know, it'll all be sorted out in the end somehow. What do you think, Mike?
Well, what you said, the last point is certainly valid, that when the Fed raises interest rates like this, something does eventually break, and we're seeing it. But what's breaking, you know, we had this one bank failure, but I do think there are going to be ripple effects that will hurt the economy, but not like these headlines repeating over and over again. So as I mentioned, this one bank that did, it's all in the news, they basically lost 20% of their net asset value. Well, I went and looked the earnings statements and so forth for a bunch of banks in the state of Virginia, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And as a whole, they've lost 5% of their net asset value because of the drop in bonds caused by inflation and rising interest rates. Well, they've lost 5%. That's not that doesn't put them in a crisis or they're going to collapse or anything like this. But the problem is, they've lost 5% of their assets. Their stocks have crashed, mm-hmm. Too, the ones that trade on the stock market.
Okay.
And if you're the CEO of one of these banks and the stock has crashed, you've got investors, you've got shareholders, and you also have fellow board of directors that you answer to. And I think what's going to happen is these people are going to react. They're going to show, well, they're going to tell their people, first of all, nothing's wrong with us. And then they're going to start to do new business initiatives. The job of the CEO is to show that he's a leader, and they want to do that by acting. And the actions they're likely to take are to be more cautious in who they lend to. So they're not going to be loaning out money in any easy way now. And then they're probably going to raise their bank fees, do things to generate some more revenue one way or the other. And they're probably going to start to go after people, which is not good. You know, it's terrible to say this, but I fear they're going to go after people that have not been paying their mortgages, and start foreclosing on people to take those debts off their books and turn it into a plus side on their ledgers.
So they're going to try and raise their assets basically to cover their minor loss. And how are they going to do it? They're going to do it incrementally just across the board, every which way they know how to generate revenue. And that's just going to become the new posture. In addition to the fact that we have this rising inflation still.
It's a mean posture. Okay. It's a mean posture to the people that aren't paying their debts. They're going to bite. They're going to bite people. I don't know how else to, like sharks. And that'll have a negative impact on the overall economy.
Well, it's got to have an impact.
You go to the bank and you go to your banker. And if you have good credit, they're friendly. They want you to take out a loan. But if you stop paying your loans, and a lot of people have not been paying their loans since 2020, and have got and they've nothing's been done to them, well, that's probably going to change.
Yeah, that's a guarantee. What about all the credit card debt, too? Because a lot of these banks have the lines of credit out there, right? So that's going to become part of this equation as well.
Sure.
You know,
collection agencies, people will be working overtime. They'll probably raise their credit card fees, which already, I mean, the interest I see on the credit card statements I get is over 20%. It's like 23% or something. The ones my credit cards, it's what they want to charge me if I don't pay my balance.
Well, that used to be the rate they gave to people that were big credit risks. Now it seems like it's across the board.
Now
everybody's
everybody.
Getting that.
You got a good credit risk, they're getting you for that.
Right, right. But I mean, you know, that was like the whole, you know, like, hey, you have bad credit. We'll give you a credit card, but of course they would kill you with the interest. You know, like the first premiers and Capital One built a whole business on it. Now they are a bank, right? they were like this weird credit card company, and they became a bank, Capital One, right? I mean, like, they were a bank to begin with, but they were like a small bank that dealt with a lot of high-risk people and started doing the secured credit card thing en masse. And, yeah, that was what they did. And then they sold off all these bad debts and turned it into a very large entity. I mean, because I remember Capital One was like a brand new thing, like in the late 90s, I guess it was. Mid to late 90s, somewhere in there. And they were a very small bank that, again, was like, we'll take the risk on you, right? And then there was a little trend there for a bit where, like, pop stars and stuff put out their own card, right? Like, different celebrities had their own credit card. Do you remember that?
I don't remember that, but I believe it.
It happened for a little bit. It was like, you know, I forget who it was, but, I mean, it was just a certain... I can't think of it now, but there was like a couple of rappers even had put out like a credit card. It was really odd. And I think it was mostly backed by like the first premiers and, Capital Ones of the world. Anyway, point is that this will change the way things are being done right now and at a bad time because again, people's revenue didn't go up, but the prices all did. So, you know, here we go. You're going to have a literal slowdown in the quantity of spending. Even if the same money is being spent, it's worth less, and therefore it is getting less goods moved around. So that's going to change the dynamic, too. All right.
And anyway, this could all be stuff that's literally happening or starting right now.
Well, I think it already did start. Yeah. See, that's the thing. Is this not just the fallout from all this pressure that you and I have been talking about now for the past year, where, you know, I'm saying, look, when they were reporting, well, there's been a 12%, you know, a bit of inflation on this and that, and I said 12, it's more like 40. And then as time went on, it got bigger and bigger. And we talked about, you know, obviously we keep talking about the grocery bill because that's the most observable thing, and everybody's got to eat. Okay, so, you know, I mean, unless you are self-sufficient and growing your own food, and all of it, in fact, you're buying it from somebody, and if you are, you're paying more. And it didn't matter what happened to the fuel price. I mean, you know, we talked about that, too, about 2 years ago. We're entering a different time
here.
Let me
ask you this. Yeah. I'm not following the political campaigns. Like, well, I mean, it's just Biden right now on the Democrats. But with the Republicans, these different Republicans, you know, we've seen the Nikki Haley, we've seen the guy in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's talk of the fellow Senator Scott in South Carolina might run, and Trump, of course, he's the first one that announced. Right, are any of them presenting any solutions to this?
Well, I mean, their whole solution, as far as I can tell, is put us back in power all the way around, and we'll fix it. As far as
but how?
Well, this is all posturing right now, okay, right? It's just the, it's like the previews for the movie before the movie goes to the theaters, okay, where it's like coming in 2024, here comes the race that's going to change things. And this is what they're doing. It's all over the place. It's really, really kind of strange because, you know, you have DeSantis who has become very popular And they're trying to see, you know, Trump's trying to engage with DeSantis at CPAC and this and that. That's all going on, and everybody's throwing up their hands going, what in the hell is Biden doing during all this? Because I don't think he's actually declared that he's going to run. But, you know, the big question on the other side of the aisle, allegedly, is, well, who else do we have if we don't run Biden again? It's just, you know, it's a whole lot of posturing. And of course, they're doing the underlying stuff. Like right now in Congress, there's lots of hearings on different things. You know, you even have Jim Jordan being nice to Matt Taibbi during hearings about Twitter, right? The Twitter files and all this. Because look, you know, there's a bunch of things going on. I think we're going to see a lot of investigations, a lot of, you know, throwing mud. It's going to happen. I mean, Trump's under investigation here and Trump's under investigation there. And what are they going to do to him in Georgia? And what are they going to do to him in New York? Yeah, and I got
to
tell you,
it sounds like a story to a show to make the TV ratings drop and bore people.
Yeah, but not really, because it'll engage some people who want to be hateful with Trump. They'll get into that. And then on the other side of the equation, you'll have, hey, look, the Democrats weaponized the government against you. You know, this is why you're hurting, because the Democrats weaponized the government, and they weaponized the media, and they used the FBI against people, and blah, blah, blah. And that's going to go on. And, oh, by the way, Hunter Biden's laptop. So I think that's, you know, at least that's the previews they're giving us. You know, they're running it against the test audiences right now.
Where is the laptop?
Oh, please. Which one? There's more than one now. So, I think we're going to get into that tomorrow night quite a bit. And we're almost out of time, Mike. I know you got to get going. Okay. Right around 9 o'clock.
But, yeah.
You know, but the thing is, there's a lot going on. There's a lot to the political stagecraft that is being mm-hmm. set up, you know, so a lot of the groundwork's getting done. As far as, does anybody have a real answer for anything? You know, good question, because do they ever? But the answer here will be, look, you think everything sucks? Well, it's because there's a Democrat in the White House. You know, and on the other side, it'll be, hey, you know, the Republicans are in charge for a little while now. You know, by the time we get to 2024, they've got control of the House and the Senate. And what are they doing? That's what it's going to be. So, you know, I say stay tuned, because they haven't really laid out the full storyline. They've just, you know how they give you a short trailer for a movie at first and you kind of know what's going on? That's the stage we're at for the 2024 selection process, you know, where it's just, it's the short trailer. Give it a couple more months, and then they're going to give you the long trailer. Okay, now here's the real issues. Here's a few more of the characters. We've already tested it with the audience now.
Yeah. Unfortunately, so, yeah. I know exactly what you mean about the movie trailers, because mm-hmm. I used to go to the movies at least once a month, mm-hmm. and then I stopped going to the movies because I don't like the movies anymore. I think they started to suck a long time ago, so I stopped going. And now I don't even see the trailers. And I'm thinking that's what's going to happen to a lot of people with this political stuff, too.
Right, right. Well, I think at the end of the day, it may cause a whole lot more people to just say, look, I've had it, and I'm not going to participate, which I don't know if that'll be a good thing or not. I think, I mean, you know, ultimately it's a good thing. But I think if people aren't paying attention, though, a lot of crazy things are going to go on, and then they're going to wonder what happened.
That's true, too. Next thing you know, they'll just, when people don't pay attention, they take advantage and just do ripoffs.
Right.
And they just.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if this bank thing is going to be part of that. You know, if there's going to be a giant, you know, let's prop up the banks, and even though you're not going to pay for it, you're really going to pay for it. You know what I mean? I really do feel like that. I know theoretically you're not supposed to, but I think we're going to pay for it one way or another. And it's either going to be, you know, right up front and on the back end with the added inflation and the troubles with, you know, getting money loaned and all that, like you were talking about, or it'll be something that, you know, oh, well, we meant to do it this way, but we couldn't because it got too large. See, that's the thing, is I'm just wondering if this is going to continue to ripple and be a much bigger problem in the next few months. And look, if everybody really starts hurting from this kind of thing, then mismanagement of it will become a huge issue. Okay. And yeah, they're going to be able to use it as a truncheon to batter Biden with it. But what's going to be said about the Congress being controlled by who it's being controlled by? If they're just involved with, you know, examining the Twitter files and Hunter Biden's laptop, and, well, if that's what they do, then are people going to actually get mad? Are they going to say, hey, you know what? Why don't you fix what the hell is going on here? Are they? Will they? I don't know. And by the way, who's actually responsible for it? How about all of them? You know, they've all fed into this mess. But anyway, I don't know, Mike. I throw up my hands. I'm not sure. I just know it's going to be an interesting show in 2024 for sure. Is anything going to get better or worse no matter who gets into office where? I doubt it. I think we're on a trajectory, and I'm not sure exactly where all this is going. You know, do you think we're looking at a time when those guys who are trying to tell us to buy gold and silver only might be right? I mean, is that where we're headed, or do you think this is just a temporary sort of situation and we're just going to feel the pain in slow motion like we have been pretty much for the past, I don't know, ever since that collapse in 2008 when they kept telling us about the recovery that nobody ever felt? You think it'll be like that, or you think it'll be something that's a little more drastic, a little more sudden? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I mean, we didn't have the big inflation until really 2 years ago is when it started.
Right.
So I would just say what we've been experiencing the past couple years is what we're going to keep experiencing.
Mm.
But I do, actually, for the short run, though, I actually think the inflation will decline that we've been seeing, or it won't be as bad, I guess, is another the more apt way to put it, because
really?
If these banks don't lend as much, it will slow the economy down, and that'll, you know, make the demand drop somewhat, which would have a dampening effect on the inflation. So I think it won't be as bad for the next couple months, but and then come back worse.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I mean, it's sort of like, hey, you know what, you want to try and walk on a broken knee or a broken ankle, you know, and
yeah.
That's going to be your choices. Mike Swanson, the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com, the author of The War State and Why the Vietnam War. Appreciate you for talking to us. You going to be back with us again next week, or we got another break?
No, I'll be here the week after that, though.
Okay. Excellent. So we'll talk to you again in 2 weeks. In the next hour, everybody, Larry Hancock and a special guest. So stick around. The Ocelli Effect will continue after this.
Oh, it's always great to hear Larry. It'd be interesting.
Oh, always.
And whoever he's got, this is new, too.
Yes.
Do you like history? Real history that you were never taught in schools? Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, by author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before that'll open your eyes to events that led up to this. Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961. Get your copy today at Amazon.com. Why? The Vietnam War, by author Mike Swanson.
What are the dynamics of a crowd? How do you move a mob? How do you excite them? How do you make them feel as one with you?
I don't know how.
Join them first.
Join them?
Yes. When you speak to them as if you were a member of the mob. Speak to them in their language, on their level. Make their hate your hate. If they are poor, talk to them of poverty. If they are afraid, talk to them of their fears. If they are angry, give them objects for their anger. But most of all, the thing that is most of the essence is that you make this mob an extension of yourself. What are the dynamics of a crowd? How do you move a mob? How do you excite them? How do you make them feel as one with you? Join them first.
Join them?
Yes. When you speak to them as if you were a member of the mob. Speak to them in their language, on their level. Make their hate your hate. If they are poor, talk to them of poverty. If they are afraid, talk to them of their fears. If they are angry, give them objects for their anger. But most of all, for their anger, most of all, the essence is that you make this mob an extension of yourself.
Every time I put it on my face, I'm able to breathe just a little bit deeper.
What are people saying about mytrueessence.net? I'm going to tell you something serious, man. I just want to tell you listeners, I bought some of that Modifilin from Christy, and she made me up some of this emu oil mixed with some other stuff. I don't know what's in it, but I like the way it smelled. And I started putting it on, rubbing it on my foot, rubbing it on my knee, and like the second day, I just noticed it. I'm walking around, I'm like, damn, my knee is loose.
I can tell you that oil you gave me helped me with my carpal and my shoulder problem. If it wasn't, I wouldn't be working.
My ankles started to really be pesky and bother me. And I'm telling you, the pain just went away. That's the oil's rule.
And when I put that on, it's like my skin came alive.
MyTrueEssence.net.
The Ocelli.com radio network.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough.
Maybe you're thinking about getting started.
WallStreetWindow.com.
Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge.
WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Uncle, do you remember that time when Benjamin Fulford said that an Asian secret society was going to dispatch ninjas to take down the Illuminati?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, in the cartoon.
Yeah, did that ever work out too good?
No.
It didn't, did it?
Didn't work.
But here on Ocelli.com radio network, things work out a bit better, don't they?
Much better.
I mean,
it's clearer in understanding about the programs. The programs are much clearer. Getting live people into it, they really have a good conversation going.
Much better.
Much better scene.
I say forget Benjamin Fulford and his ninjas and listen to the Ocelli.com radio network.
I agree. It's straight to the point.
Straight talk.
And I like that idea.
Ocelli.com.
Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Second hour, but the third segment of the Ocelli Effect here on a Thursday, and we are live. And I'm glad that we are. I was happy to talk to Mike Swanson in the first hour, but second hour now. Here, this has been rare lately. the author Larry Hancock is with me, and as per usual, I'll mention to you that he occupies. And I was just moving my books around on my shelf too. You occupy more spots on my bookshelf than any other author. Okay. Thankfully, we're not going to discuss Russia tonight. Okay, just spoiler alert. That's not going to happen. At least I don't think so. Although, well, we might get into it. But we have somebody else with us. And, you know, Larry, first of all, I'm really, really happy that you suggested a gentleman who is thinking differently than some others. And here's another spoiler for you. We're going to get into the JFK stuff a bit. We could wind up discussing Russia because of the one particular titular figure that is going to have to be discussed during this hour. And I'm going to shut up and really, try to take a listen to some new ideas, at least new to me. They may not be new to some other people, but they're new to me. So here we go. What's new to Chuck when it comes to this stuff, right? Anyway, doesn't matter. Larry, first off, really glad to have you here. Of course, you're the author of Someone Would Have Talked, Creating Chaos. We're not discussing that book tonight. Surprise Attack, Shadow Warfare, co-author, all kinds of stuff. Larry-Hancock.com. Go there, check it out, and always catch up on Larry's blog because that is a point of interest at all times, and there'll be links in the show notes to all of it. So, Larry, how you doing tonight, first off?
I'm doing good, Chuck. It's good to be back and talking about JFK again, which is kind of a place where you and I started some of our conversations. So it feels good to return to some of that territory for a change.
No, absolutely. And given the fact that I don't want to discuss bank collapses with you, and that seems to be what's in the news cycle, and I just did that in the last hour, yeah, let's change the subject. Well, we need to. And we have another gentleman with us. His name is Greg Doudna. Now, I actually learned how to pronounce his name during the break. Okay, no kidding. But I did read something this gentleman wrote, and maybe another piece or two I glanced over. I may have to request this guy to come back on a couple of times, okay, because here we go. Somebody's going to make a presentation that's very different, and I'm going to get you guys a link and put it in the chat room at Ocelli.com, which we do have a live chat at all times, and if you're hearing this in replay or whatever, you can always roll the chat back and take a look, but also look at the show notes because an article this gentleman wrote will be there linked so you can go to it and look at it for yourself, but Greg, your first time on the show. Glad to have you along, sir. How are you doing tonight?
Well, fine, thank you, and I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad Larry's here, too.
Oh, absolutely. Look, Greg, everybody who listens to my show, unless you're just, you know, discovering the show, welcome to it. You know who Larry Hancock is. I've done a series on every one of his books. I've done discussions with him about things that he hasn't written a book about, but he studied. I love talking to Larry. I talk politics with Larry. I talk news with Larry. I talk history with Larry. But you've never been on. So now there's a bunch of people hearing your voice tonight. Who is Greg Doudna? If you had to just give a general introduction, especially considering why it is I've dragged you into the show tonight.
Well, I've had some discussions with Larry Hancock, who has been very, I can't say how much I respect Larry's work and on the John F. Kennedy assassination, and so I've got into a bit of research of my own on some of these subjects, just you know decided to write up a few things that seem to come together for me and hope to make a contribution. I live in Bellingham, Washington, and just have a quiet life with my wife Caroline, and so I'm glad to be here.
Just sort of a regular guy who got sucked into this, huh? is that a good description?
Yeah, I'm a recent newcomer in the sense that I've been studying it pretty seriously only for about maybe the past 3 years or so, not as long as a lot of people.
Right. About how old are you, by the way? I didn't even check your age.
Yeah, I'm 68.
Ah, okay. No, fair enough. But it's interesting to me when somebody comes to it a little later in life, because I started studying this as a teenager, and I'm 50 years old now, you know, and it's been an interesting evolution. And the topic of the article that Larry showed me, and I got to apologize for not being aware of your work before, but look, it's impossible for me to keep track of everybody who writes things about this case, right? I do my best and try to keep up on the books and try to keep up on people who have new and interesting ideas that make sense to help us make sense of, you know, that event which occurred on November 22nd, 1963. But your area of focus in this article is, that figure. Now, why did I say we could talk about Russia for a minute? Because Lee Harvey Oswald, his defection, etc. But you have an interesting take, and so tell me about what caused you to become interested in Oswald, if you don't mind, and then let's talk about the content of the article. You're aware of which article I'm referring to, right?
Yes, it's an article that I've just recently produced on the case of the shot that was fired into the General Edward Walker home on April 10th, 1963. It doesn't get as much attention as some of the other things involved with the Kennedy assassination and Oswald. It actually is – my paper is totally about the Walker case. It does not address the John F. Kennedy assassination directly. Mm-hmm. That's what my – I basically came and studied it pretty deeply and came to maybe a different angle of looking at some of the things on it.
Well, look, Larry, I'll need you to pipe up here and help me out with a little bit of context. Let's just say for the uninitiated listener, right, Edwin Walker, now, if you've painstakingly decided to study this particular patch of history, in the 50s and the 60s and gone into some of, well, the more interesting characters. You certainly encountered Edwin Walker. Really, post-World War II, you could go all over the place with this guy. But anyway, for somebody who's never heard of Edwin Walker, what would you lay out there to explain it to them? Because Lee Harvey Oswald is alleged to have taken a shot to try and kill Edwin Walker very shortly before the assassination. So maybe you could give us a bit of context here in short.
Sure. Generally, people that know about Walker know about him as a figure from the ultra-right in the early 60s. He was a military officer in the Army, Army officer in the European Command in Germany, and actually was very aggressive politically as a military officer, which some of that was not unexpected at the time, but he actually began issuing orders that would have politicized his troops that he was in command of, persuaded them towards certain very right-wing views, and it became significant enough so that it was actually reported up the chain of command. Long-term, bottom line is he was relieved from his command, and President Kennedy actually became involved in that process. Mm-hmm. So there is a kind of a contentious relationship between Walker and JFK from a political spectrum, and certainly Walker was not only against JFK's policies, he was, because of his ultra-right position, he was against, any type of relations, any type of neutrality, any type of talks. He was very much a rabid Cold War mentality. But beyond that, he's also a figure from the, basically from the integration movement at the time. He very strongly opposed school integration and actually showed up at the University of Mississippi when the Kennedy administration was trying to integrate the campus and actually put an African-American student on campus, and was actually arrested for inciting to violence, having weapons, so he was antagonistic towards the Kennedy administration from both its politics and its racial policies.
Right.
He was a Texan, was pretty well known in the Texas political scene from the ultra-right, known to the Minutemen. The Minutemen would kind of give you a feel for the kind of groups that both the anti-integration movement and the Minuteman anti-communist movement kind of give you a feel for who he was associated with. And actually, in 1963 and 1964, he was gearing up to run for office in Texas again, which he had before. So he was very politically visible in Texas at the time.
Right.
I think one thing to set a backstory for this is at the time of the actual assassination, the Walker shooting was not part of the immediate story. It only entered into the JFK assassination after the fact, due to some media activities, due to the FBI investigation, and quite frankly, due to the Warren Commission effort to come up with a motive for Oswald that would show that he was a violent individual.
And right.
With a propensity to do things like try to kill people. So this was not a first day story really for the assassination. It evolved over time.
Right, but it becomes useful because Oswald was publicly involved with things that, well, let's just be loose about it. We could call them a sort of pro-communist or pro-left, movements, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee incident, et cetera, right? So he's the crazy commie that really wanted to strike out at something that was working against him one way or another, right? So Kennedy's, policies and activities with Cuba, the Bay of Pigs, etc. It's very convenient that he takes a shot at another figure to try and make himself famous, which, again, they never properly formed a motive, the Warren Commission, for Lee Harvey Oswald. And quite frankly, I've always sort of defaulted to one of the reports where Walker talked about, you know, digging the bullet out of the wall himself and saying that, well, it's not that kind of bullet, et cetera. But it's part of the deep dive into the story that you have to get into, because the allegation is, yeah, go ahead.
It's part of the deep dive also because as this story evolved, clearly Walker is mentioned in Oswald's notebook. There are factual proofs that Oswald was interested in Walker in some fashion, and there are factual proofs, including photos
yeah.
from Oswald's possession of Walker's residence. So, you know, we also have to deal with the fact that the evidence that did emerge after the assassination did suggest, you know, some sort of connection.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Look, when you have the idea that he took photographs of Walker's house, you have Marina, now very confusing testimony from her that at certain points it seems like she thought that he had gone and maybe taken a shot at Walker, in support of the idea that this was a man willing to kill to make a political point. It's sort of a character witness, even though there was no adversarial procedure here for Oswald. It's part of the narrative, right? And that's where I'll leave it, because now we got to get to Greg, all right? And interesting that you come to it later. How much about this did you know before you dove into this study recently? I mean, had you ever heard of the Walker shooting?
Oh, yeah.
Previous to those 3 years? I mean, was it just something that came up and you said, okay, that's interesting, until you decided to really dive into it, or what?
Well, I was in fourth grade when John F. Kennedy was shot, and it was traumatic to me, just as it was for the rest of the nation. And I've followed the Kennedy story over the years, and you know, I've just sort of all along have had the idea that it just looked like this was a hit of some kind. I didn't know who did it or know much about it, but I would read articles and a little bit of things along the line, and but it was only recently that I became immersed into the documents on the Mary Farrell Foundation site and reading the books of Larry Hancock and others. I just got into it because it seemed like the questions were interesting. And, you look at a case and you wonder if there's a way to crack a case a different way than has been normally thought of.
Well, right. And I appreciate people that, don't just take the word of previous authors and run with it, okay? Because that's one of the most disappointing things, quite honestly, because I've read hundreds of books on this case. I've seen, I don't even know how many presentations I've seen, if I combine, stuff that I've seen on video and DVD along with stuff I've seen in person. I mean, for God's sake. I've been over these things so many times. I can't stand it when somebody just defers to someone else's work. Do your own work, you know. Not yelling at anybody on this show, trust me. But and that's an interesting point here. You've done some interesting steps through here. So let's get into this. Like, why was this important for you to focus on? Do you think that it is a significant piece of evidence? Because, I mean, some people could dismiss the Walker shooting as, well, look, it speaks to his character, maybe his propensity to commit violence, if you're looking to convict Oswald. But otherwise, is it of any use historically? Somebody might argue. So if you don't mind, start off there and then tell us about what is contained in this article, please. Which, again, I've dropped at Ocelli.com and will be in the show notes. But Greg Doudna, sorry again about your last name, but people do it to me all the time. Please go ahead.
Sure. Okay, Chuck. Yes, the case of this Walker shot is it's formally distinct from the issue of who shot Kennedy, because that's a separate case, separate arguments and evidence. But it's been so influential because. For example, one of the key witnesses of the Warren Commission was Ruth Payne, and I happen to actually know Ruth Payne in the St. Petersburg Friends meeting in the year 2001 to 2002, 2003. I knew her back then. And she was convinced that Oswald shot Kennedy. She never had any personal evidence of that, never claimed to have personal evidence of that, but she believed it because of the evidence that the Warren Commission had and so forth and so on. But the main thing, and she said this herself, was that she said he had tried to kill before. That was what convinced her and many, many others in America that it was plausible. It added force to the idea that Oswald was the assassin of Kennedy, in addition to the actual direct argument from the evidence on the case of the Kennedy assassination. So this has been very influential in linking that, and Larry gave the background on it and so forth, and that's all correct. And so the thing about the Walker shot, there's been basically the argument that Oswald did shoot Walker was you have some physical evidence that was found in Oswald's belongings, and then you had Marina sort of confessed and said that her husband Lee did it. So that was the basic, and it had been an unsolved case up to that point, so you didn't have anybody else that did it, and then you've got these things that connect Oswald to it. So that was the thing that was pretty convincing to most people. Mm. Now, there has been a pushback on that, and the pushback has been largely, not 100%, but largely from people that are maybe taking the other side of the, the lone nut interpretation. The pushback has been to basically say that the physical evidence was forged or planted, and the sticking point, though, is what to do with Marina's testimony, and that has been explained in a way that I do not find credible at all. But the argument is that Marina, she was basically sort of threatened, whether indirectly or directly, about her deportation and immigration status, and was basically coerced or influenced or scripted or whatever to frame her own husband and to stick with that story for 50 years. I don't find that believable at all.
Let me ask you this about that in particular at the time, right? It would be totally reasonable to assume, though, that she might have been intimidated whether someone did that actively or she was simply intimidated by the circumstances to be implicated. I mean, she had children. What was going to happen to them? Would they suffer the fallout from this thing that her husband, whether he's guilty or not, is the accused assassin? So there was also the trouble, which is the only thing I ever point to, of interpretation, because she had difficulty with translation. There were different translators at different points, and if you're looking at it from the immediate aftermath of the events in 63, it's very possible that there were some misstatements, misunderstandings, etc. But she did give this story in support of it, and indeed we do know that that he took photographs of Walker's house. Someone, whoever that might be, did take a shot at Walker, literally in his study or whatever it is you want to call it, his office there at home. Somebody shot through a window, and he himself, according to what I understand, dug a bullet out of the wall. There was a bullet fired at him through a window, and didn't miss by a lot. And if she backs that up, and we have this issue that he took a shot at him, well, then, yeah, it would lend itself to this is a guy who's willing to kill. Now, the only thing that I look also to push back at, now, I don't push back on the idea of saying that anything was planted here. I figure that somebody took a shot at Walker. Now, as for whether it's Oswald or not, I think that needs to be proven. You got a little bit of a difficulty in that the bullet that Walker says he had in his hand and handed over to somebody at some point was not a 6.5 Manlich or Carcano bullet. But other than that, I mean, what's to say Oswald didn't have another gun we don't know about? Would be very easy, as everybody likes to point out, for a young man in Texas to go pick up another gun. It's not that hard in 1963 at all. Probably not that hard right now. Another hunting rifle, for instance, just theoretically. No problem. He could have gotten one, gotten rid of it, and nobody ever saw it, right? So
let me insert one thing that at that point in time that kind of you and Greg have laid out the kind of point counterpoint story that, you know, the Oswald, as far as Warren Commission box is concerned, is, you know, he had the character to be a killer. He had the character to carry out assassins and fire at people. You know, he was a lone nut that could shoot at people. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one storyline. What the Warren Commission, though, and what the FBI avoided, which I think it's important for Greg to pursue here, is that there is another view of this, that this would have could have led an investigation to conspiracy. And the conspiracy being the fact that this action against General Walker was not an independent action on Lee Harvey's part, but an action that was consistent with his contact with and outreach to ultra-right figures in Dallas, just as we can see him associated with ultra-right figures in New Orleans. One of the things, and one of the things that really got me interested in this is we've had to come to face in recent years new sources and new information that have really raised a kind of a bifurcated view of Oswald. And we know now that before Oswald ever left Dallas, that he was interested in the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, leafleting for – he was doing the same sort of things in Dallas that he would later do in New Orleans. Part of that pattern may well be that he reached out to the ultra-right in Dallas before he did so in New Orleans. And I just wanted to kind of set that context because this is – there are pieces of data and information that we've learned only in the last few years that highlight that. And this is a story that's – people just don't talk about anymore. They don't talk about the concept that what happened with Walker may not be what the Warren Commission presented because they had an agenda in presenting it, but it may have happened in a conspiratorial context. And having said that, I'll shut up.
Well, there you go. Yes. You got to open that up. So Greg, go ahead and take it from there if you don't mind.
Sure. There's a third way to look at – there's a third possibility to approach the Walker shot. That is, it's an idea. It's not – it's been around for a while. Some people have suggested this. And it was actually an early suspicion of the police themselves, and that was the idea that the shot was staged. Now, many people might remember the Guardian Angels and Curtis Sliwa, and he – had public sympathy and support for the Guardian Angels, but he faked a kidnapping of himself for publicity.
Yes, he did.
And
yes.
Then he confessed it later. And I saw that as the thing is that there was a number. So basically my paper, the research I did, dug into and supported the idea that, the shot was staged by Walker's people on behalf of him. Mm-hmm. And that it was not an attempted murder as it was presented to be. And I go into quite a bit of detail making that argument. The argument, again, was suspected early on by law enforcement. The idea actually was a strong suspicion, and then it declined because of the perception that, well, Marina said that Oswald did it, so it looks like it really was a murder attempt, and because Marina said that's what Lee told her it was. So that's the sort of the my argument has been that it's been seemingly that there's been two contradictory things. Either Oswald took the shot and tried to kill, or it was either. In other words, I'm taking the argument that both are correct, that Oswald did fire the shot, but it was not attempted murder, and it was a stage shot. And that now that is a tough one to make because you would think, well, how could it be a stage shot if Oswald took the shot?
Well also because, look, people that are involved in political gamesmanship one way or another could easily seize upon something as an opportunity, whether they actively staged it or not, right? Oh, this will be a good chance for me to say that, look, I'm so intensely important that somebody's willing to kill me, whether they were actively involved in setting that up or whether this, you know, or they're just seizing on the opportunity, right? So, I mean, there's actually a world of possibilities here that were not considered by most people who have talked about this in the past, Greg. I mean, what do you think?
And I want to mention that there's actually new information that has come to light that the Warren Commission did not know about. It's not in any Mary Farrell Foundation site document. It's not in any FBI document. There's a new information that came about, first published in 2017 by Gail Nix Jackson in a book called Pieces of the Puzzle. And she had access to videotaped interviews of the two sons of Robert Suri. And Robert Suri was an aide to General Walker. And Robert Suri later became known as an advocate of the American Nazi Party. And he had those sympathies in 1963. Whether or not he was actually public about that, it is not quite clear. In 1963, he was public about it, in 1964 for sure. But in any case, what came about, and this was the key sort of breakthrough, is that there was a witness right after the shot named Kirk Coleman, 14 years old. He heard the shot. He climbs a fence. He sees this parking lot, the church parking lot, next to General Walker's house. He sees two cars leaving. This has been widely known and reported. Everybody knows about this that's looked at this case. He saw these two cars leaving with two individuals. They've never been identified. The Warren Commission knew about this. The FBI knew about this. These individuals and these two individuals, two vehicles, have never been identified in all this time, not by researchers, not by the FBI, and so they've been unidentified.
Right. Now, just for the listener, you lay this out actually in this article very well. To let people know that there is this thing that goes on with these cars in the church parking lot that you establish really well. You lay it out in this article. So go ahead.
Yeah. So the breakthrough is that the evidence is extremely clear that I see that one of those cars can be identified, and that was the car of Robert Suri. This identification was not made before, and it really wasn't able to be made before because the color of Robert Suri's car wasn't known. But it was revealed by the son of Robert Suri, and it was a black over white sedan, two-door. Mm-hmm. Actually, Robert Suri's car was a convertible, I should say. And the color of the car, and it matches, and it was Robert Suri's car, and it was Robert Suri. And that means that Robert Suri was in the house with General Walker at the time of the shot. And that identification of Robert Suri as Kirk Coleman's man number two, that's how they term him in the FBI documents, man number two. That identification was the breakthrough, because David Suri, the son of Robert Suri, actually in his adult life in the year 2013, told about how he was there that night with his father in the house at the time of the shot, and left with his father in his father's car right after the shot. Mm-hmm. And Robert Suri said differently to the FBI and to the Warren Commission. And yet Kirk Coleman saw him leave right after the shot, and Robert Suri's son in later years said that he was there when he was 12 years old. And left.
Now, this is a big contradiction to what was previously stated about this, because as far as everybody's always been told, Walker is alone in his study, and there's nobody there with him, in fact, right? At the time that this bullet comes through the window and strikes the wall, something about he bent down or something, like last minute. I mean, very, very much like something that comes out of a TV show, right, where he just missed. You know, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's always been that he was alone in this study, right?
That's the story, and now I found out something interesting about that. That is, there's nothing in the Warren Commission testimony or in there's nothing in Walker's sworn testimony where he said he was alone. However, that was reported by the press, and Steve Rowe brought that to my attention, that that there was a press news report the next day that where Walker told reporters he was alone, and yet he wasn't alone. Both Walker. He was not alone, and Suri lied under oath and said he was not there at the house when he clearly was from the Kirk Coleman seeing the car leave right after the shot.
Right. Steve Rowe, by the way, for the listeners, has been on the show many times doing the JFK Myths episodes. He's generally a guy who, quite frankly, supports the Warren Commission's conclusions for the most part, but has done some really fascinating research into various subjects, and including the discussion about George H.W. Bush and exactly where he was on the day of the assassination. In case you guys forgot who Steve Rowe is, and who knows, maybe he'll be back on the show sometime soon. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I just wanted to give that reference there since you brought him up. And Gail's been on the show too, by the way. Mainly I talked to her about, you know, about her grandfather's film. But, anyway, Gail Nix Jackson, interesting lady, and has written a couple of interesting pieces on the assassination, not just about her grandfather's film, but yes, indeed, she did this, interesting interview. So, go ahead. I'm sorry. I just wanted to give everybody a little bit of reference there.
Right. And in a sense, it was the Gail Nix Jackson book, that, really was the sort of the key to me on this identification of the car. And in the Gail Nix Jackson book, she put out the evidence there of the colors of the car and so forth, and didn't quite close that connection and say that was the car. That was Robert Seary's car that Kirk Coleman saw, his car number two. And I missed it when I read Gail Nix Jackson's book the first couple of times. And then I studied it over again, and I saw this connection, and I said, it's been missed. Nobody's noticed this. This is the car. This is the first time that one of Kirk Coleman's two cars can be identified. And this is new information. This is actually new that the Warren Commission, the FBI, private researchers, independent researchers have missed. Even the Gail Nix Jackson book didn't actually close that case on making that identification of the car, even though it was the breakthrough, because she presented the information there that made that possible.
Right. Now, Greg, do me a favor here and just fill the listener in case they haven't read the article yet, exactly why this is important, because you're talking about a church parking lot. We're talking about, you know, his house, Walker's house, which is where the incident allegedly occurred, right, where he's in his study in his home. But where is this church parking lot? Give people an idea, draw them a picture, and exactly why this is important, and what the timing is, because there were a few vehicles that were eliminated. I guess there was some investigation here, but they seem to stop a bit short too, maybe because, well, you know, it is what it is, and it's somebody taking a shot at Walker, which, by the way, shouldn't be a big surprise considering that he was a controversial figure that might have incited some people to be reactionary, considering reactionary figures get reactions, don't they? So, I mean, you know, do us a favor. Just kind of break that down for people.
Well, yeah. General Walker lived on on Turtle Creek Boulevard residential district in a sort of a large home, a mansion, right next to a Latter-day Saints church with a parking lot. And then there was the shot that occurred 9 p.m. on a hot day on April 10th. Somebody took a shot at him in the alley. That person was identified as Oswald that took the shot for the reasons named. But the thing is that the two cars and two persons leaving within 20 or 25 seconds after the shot, seen by Kirk Coleman, that's never been explained. Mm-hmm. Some people say, well, those were church people leaving, which is theoretically possible, except for the fact that there was a lot of informal questioning among the church people to try to find out who those cars belonged to and those individuals, and they did not match them to anybody in the church there. So that's a pretty good argument that it wasn't. And the location of these cars were right next to the Walker House end of the parking lot, the farthest away from the church. So those two things say that it was probably connected to the Walker House and the shot.
Rather suggestive,
And the other thing is that Robert Seary himself, I mean, he's on the record. He actually parked his convertible right in the spot where, in that same area of the parking lot, where Kirk Coleman saw his car number two leave. So this is a spot that it's known as a matter of record that Robert Suhr used to park his car. And the significance of this is that you ask yourself, why did Robert Suhr falsely tell the FBI and falsely tell the Warren Commission that he didn't arrive, he wasn't there, and he didn't arrive till 15 minutes later? He was covering up the fact that he was there. Now, that's odd.
Why would he? He clearly isn't the guy who took the shot, unless you're saying that he might have. Because no, if he arrives 15
shot.
Minutes later,
he's in the house
sorry,
with his son. But so basically, the reconstruction is that Oswald fired the shot, but Walker was not in the room, and it was a staged shot. Suhr organized it, and it was a staged shot for publicity. And there's quite a bit of circumstantial evidence to support that. So it's not as outrageous as it's not just a matter of saying, well, we'll just say that it's a staged shot. There's actually an argument for that. And it's supported by the fact, I mean, one of the supporting things is that Robert Suhr, who was probably the one that organized it, was dishonest about his presence there. And his presence is witnessed by Kirk Coleman, who was a high quality, credible witness.
Right.
Everybody basically agrees with that.
Well, he's independent of the situation,
right?
Wouldn't have a reason to report, and he's only reporting this car. He's not saying he's not fingering the guy necessarily. He's reporting a car, which you can then piece together. I mean, that's the way real circumstances occur here, unless he knew Suhr himself or something like that, right? So this is starting to make a lot of sense.
Well, it also begins to make a lot of sense, and Doug should talk about this. There's also anecdotal evidence that Oswald may well have known Suhr and have been in contact with Suhr and been in contact with some people within the Walker clique, as it were, in Dallas.
That was going to be my next question. So glad you grabbed that one, Larry. And by the way, feel free to take the lead here as we go through this, because I want to lay this out for people. And, you know, remember, not everybody's fully aware of all the characters and why this would make sense to anybody. Very good to lay these things out. Like I said, even let's lay out why the church parking lot's important. If you look over the layout, the where this was in relation to Walker's house and all of that, it starts to make a lot more sense. So, go ahead, Doug. I mean, sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Greg.
Exactly right. What Larry said, and Chuck, these are really good questions you're asking. David Suhr, who was the son of Robert Suhr, claims that his father knew Oswald back then. Now, that's a little, the story taken in isolation. The story could be, is a bit ambiguous because in terms of how to assess it, because there could be a false identification, a false memory. It's a long time ago and so forth and so on. But it fits the fact that Oswald was involved with that shot. And it fits the fact that Oswald, for example, to pick up on what Larry was mentioning, Oswald, according to Michael Payne, who knew him.
Right.
Michael Payne said that Oswald told him that he was spying on the right wing. And Oswald himself was not right wing. He was a left winger. The real Oswald was a left winger, although there's some dispute on that. All of his writings support the fact that he was actually left, not faking it. Mm-hmm. And why would he be hanging around with these right wingers like Edwin Walker and so forth? Well, he told Michael Payne, according to Michael Payne, he said he was spying on the right wing. And this fits into a pattern of his behavior in New Orleans. He had the appearance of being like he was surveilling or being an informant or something on these right wing groups that he were different from what he personally believed, but he, through whatever means, gained their confidence and he was, according to Robert Suhr's son, he actually was known to his father, Robert Suhr.
Well, like, for instance, most notably, the involvement with, Berenguer and approaching him in New Orleans and all that, and approaching these anti-Castro Cubans and things like that, that would be something that clearly a staunch left-winger would not do, except that he may have been trying to infiltrate the group, learn things, whatever, And he was, from all accounts, seems like, involved in different things like this. Now, we could talk about the motive or who sent him to do these things or whatever, but point is, we know that he was certainly involved with activities like this, where he is clearly interacting with people that are clearly anti-communist, anti-Castro, your right-wingy type figures of the day. He's interacting with those people, but at the same time, participating in very left-wing or left-oriented activities, being a pro-Castro or a Castro-friendly supporting person publicly, like as in handing out your Fair Play for Cuba Committee pamphlets, right? Right. So he's doing a bunch of these kind of things publicly and interacting with people like this. It would not seem strange that he's interacting with a right-wing figure, actually, if he was doing that. And I recall Michael Payne having said this kind of as a throwaway in earlier documentary footage where, people asked him about this, right? He said something about spying on the right wing. This is not new that he said he was doing this. Right. So, yeah, go ahead.
No,
go ahead.
To jump in a minute before that, something that is new that we didn't realize before that makes – this connection, the Surrey connection, the Walker connection, the spying on the ultra-right, and essentially infiltrating or doing something with them that would ingratiate him or give him some credence. What we have learned now is that when Oswald, before Bringier, what we have learned is the person who introduced Oswald to Bringier, who gave him the reference to Bringier, was Ernesto Rodriguez Jr., who ran a language school. The interesting thing is Ernesto Rodriguez Jr. was extremely right-wing. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, his father, Ernesto Sr., was essentially a Nazi supporter and had been identified as a Nazi supporter, rabid ultra-right, and directly associated with Guy Bannister. So the interesting thing is that before all this Castro leafleting and I support Castro, as soon as Oswald actually shows up and re-enters our picture in New Orleans, the contact he has is with an ultra-right figure, an ultra-right nexus that gives him these introductions. Mm-hmm. And Doug's going to enjoy this. One of the, of course, people will portray this as just a sheer circumstance. But one of the things that's turned up recently is discussion of the fact that a young man who visited Walker's residence after the shooting in Dallas, after the shooting at Walker, took some film footage. The interesting thing is the next thing on his film footage after visiting Walker's house and showing where the bullet strike was and everything else is we see in the footage, we see Lee Oswald leafleting in New Orleans. I mean, if somebody was trying to make a propaganda story to set up Lee Oswald, it would be beautiful footage. Maybe not ever used in that fashion. Maybe somebody had that idea. But I think what I really wanted to highlight is what Greg is talking about. And his study here is highlighting the connection that we have largely ignored since the Bannister inquiry, when the Garrison himself said, gee, when you look at Lee Oswald, it looks like he's a right-wing guy. And to a large extent, that's true. So we have to deal with kind of a bifurcated Lee Oswald. Is he doing something with the right wing? It appears so. Is he doing something with the – it's a very complex situation that I think a lot of people would rather ignore and kind of keep Oswald in a box so we didn't have to deal with these things.
Right. Right. Well, and there you go. So how do you deal with this, Greg? Because it is, look, I could make an argument that he's clearly involved with left-wingers. I could clearly make arguments that he's involved with right-wingers of all sorts. The interesting connection there with the Nazi sympathizer, that's something. Because, Siri, as far as I know, again, he fits the profile there. You have a serious contradiction here in the evidence, and yet we know that neither one of these is just made up. These are things that happened. one way or another. Now, you can interpret them different ways, for sure, but how do you suss that out when you're taking a look at this and piecing this together? And I mean, you know, I'll give you about another 10 minutes or so here. I know it's not fair, but another 10 minutes or so
sure.
to kind of get to what else is in the article here, because I think this is very interesting. This is a very thoughtful new look, which I don't think anyone else is doing. So I think that this is rarefied and very good. And I thank you for taking the time to explain it tonight. So go ahead and tell us how you deal with that. And whatever else you think is worthy of mention here. I want people to read this article, though. Like I said, it'll be linked with the show notes, and it is in the chat room also at the website. So either way, take a look at Greg's work and judge for yourself, because got to tell you, it makes a lot of sense to me. But, you know, that's my commentary. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, it's so odd. Most people that are not extreme right wingers themselves are not going to go on their own to seek out right wingers to hang around with them. That's just not a normal thing that a normal person that would do. That's not themselves involved in that type of group. So the fact that Oswald was drawn to the, like Larry said, that's extremely interesting and intriguing and compelling. That Oswald was doing the very thing in New Orleans that. Is the circumstantial evidence indicates he was doing with the Walker people. That is, he was becoming known and gaining their confidence. And so the reconstruction is that he gained the confidence of Surrey and participated in this staged shot that was going to help out Walker. In other words, it was presented publicly as an assassination attempt, but it was actually done with Walker's knowledge and cooperation, and it was a staged shot, which is what the police originally, privately suspected. Mm. And so my paper goes into some things as to why didn't Oswald tell Marina that it was staged, and that goes into a larger context in which he simply wasn't telling Marina everything. And so I'm interpreting Marina's testimony on what Oswald told her about how he took the shot, got home late that night, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm interpreting that as basically correct. I mean, Marina can be wrong on some things, and when she does, her testimony has a lot of problems because she did dissemble, she lied, so forth and so on throughout her testimony at times. Where I differ from where the direction some go is that I don't think she was scripted on any of that in terms of when she lied, she did it for her own reasons. There was nobody behind the scenes pulling her strings like a marionette. I don't find that plausible. But the thing is that she said that she was convinced, even in later years when Marina, who is still alive, when Marina believes that now, she believes that her husband did not kill Kennedy. Mm-hmm. So that was a later development for her. But she didn't want to believe it to begin with, but she said that, you know, the evidence convinced her it was true. And then she came later to believe that her husband was actually innocent of Kennedy. But she does not think that her husband did not take the shot at Walker. She's never backed off on that.
Well, in talking with her about 30 years ago myself, I got the impression that he was constantly involved in things where she was not fully informed.
Right.
You know, and that's what I got from her, is that he was just doing things. I forget what phrase she used. She used a phrase. It was kind of like he was out on his little missions or adventures or something. And I don't remember exactly what it was, but I got that impression that he was constantly doing things where she would know a little bit of something about it.
But, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, Chuck. In other words, Marina's testimony that Lee told her that he shot at Oswald, that is, to me, that is,
it's
you
consistent.
Know, testimony it, that yeah. that's what he told her.
It's consistent.
Not testimony. It's not
right.
evidence that he did it.
No, it's consistent with the type of thing that she would have been told if your right. theorem is correct here, right? That's about the level of information she might have been given by him anyway. Whether it was a real shot at Walker or not, it doesn't matter. He would have never fully informed her. This is what makes the most sense. In my mind, just based on what she said about their interactions, he would tell her, you know, parts of things that were going on, but they would actually fight about this, that she didn't know all of what he was involving himself in and what have you, where, you know, her statement was more like she was concerned about the family, you know, the children, this and that, could there be danger or problems or blowback from some of his activities? And his, you know, because she was a bit, let's say, sensitive to the idea that outward political activity might have, you know, caused trouble for them at home, right? Right. Which seemed sensible to me when she explained it to me that way.
Just add one thing that will liven this up a little bit, too. We also know that Lee bragged a little bit about things that he did, kind of elevated his own, you know, impact. That was characteristic of Oswald. He built himself up. He was that kind of guy. And Marina would come back and tear him down. You mentioned them getting into fights. She would laugh at him. She would poke at him. It's kind of like, no, you're not that. Which really becomes interesting when you think of the backyard photo, and people are going to throw stones, but fortunately we're on, you know, the internet. We know of an actual real copy of a backyard photo that was left with the Morin Shields.
Oh, you're going to bring this up.
Independent of all this other stuff.
Yes.
And on the front, we've got Lee addressing it. And the signature, his handwriting has been verified. On the front of it, Lee, you know, makes a note to George. Okay. On the back, Marina, in her handwriting, says, it, to paraphrase, it's kind of like, hunter of fascist.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah,
I was and that just strikes home to me. It's kind of like, I know this guy is doing this stuff with these weird people, and it just, you know, she's just poking fun at him.
It ties very nicely with Michael Payne's and also Ruth Payne's. If you even take a look at her testimony during that mock trial, where she says, you know, oh well, he would build himself up and brag and think of himself as very important and this kind of thing, which you talked about, you know, knowing Ruth Payne, I'm very certain that she stuck with that story all the way and still has to this day. That's how she felt about him, and that's the way he presented himself. But I was going to bring up that De Morin Shield photograph. It's like, you're in my head, Larry. Thanks. So
we've done too many shows, Chuck.
I think we have. But anyway, Greg, I again, you know, give you the unfair, chore of kind of wrapping this up. But this is very interesting, a new way to look at with some new information, which you have, you know, developed and made sense of in this article. Tell people the title of the article, please. Again, I'll have the link. The link is a little weird looking the way I presented it here, but you'll be able to get to it, guys. But the title of the article again, and any last little parting notion you'd like to leave the listener with, go ahead.
Yeah, the title of the article, I can't even find my page one. Well, I don't have the title. Okay. Anyway, I don't remember the title. Anyway, you can look it up on the link that you will have. The basic argument is, here's the title. Did Lee Harvey Oswald shoot at General Walker on April 10th, 1963?
Right.
And, so it's basically an argument that, there's new information that one of the cars of the important witness, Kirk Coleman, has been identified that was leaving the parking lot after the shot. It's been identified as Robert Surrey. It's an argument that picks up on the early law enforcement suspicion that it was a staged shot with a lot of features that correlate and agree with that interpretation of the shot. And if that argument is substantial, it means that Oswald did take the shot, but it was not an attempted murder. And that means that it puts it in a different light, because all along the assumption has been that Oswald did attempted murder, and that's, even though it's formally not part of the Kennedy assassination evidence, it's been so influential in you know, showing, what do you call it, that Oswald was capable of murder and he did attempt a murder and so forth with forethought and malice and so forth. And so this removes that from the influence. It does not remove any of the direct evidence pro and con on the John F. Kennedy assassination itself, but right. It does take away that strong influence, predisposition to see Oswald as a willful, premeditated murder. If this in fact was not what was going on with the Walker shot.
Well, and even though we've kind of laid out that there are many ways to interpret all of this, quite frankly, there's really only three directions you go in here, right? Which is, look, he willfully did this, whether alone or with others, okay? And he did this because he really wanted to strike out at a right-wing figure, all right? Or right. He had nothing to do with it. He was innocent. He wasn't there, okay? Right. That's usually the two positions, but this creates a third position where, yes, he's a participant, but he is a participant for a different purpose, and this could be yet another move to ingratiate himself with those people he's spying on, as, you know, as Michael Payne put it, as other people put it, as it has been demonstrated before, that he's infiltrating groups and doing different things, and his little adventures that Marina was talking about kind of all fits together into a completely different package than we've ever seen this presented before.
Very well summarized, yes.
There you go. So that's the way. And you know what? You've written some other stuff, too, and I want to get to that in the future. But tonight we're going to leave it here. But, Larry, do you think this has been a fair summation of the points of interest in this article?
Oh, I think that's a great summary. And to me, it's important that we revisit some of these things. We have some new information both about Dallas and New Orleans. And I'm very much into revisiting Oswald in 1963. Mm-hmm. What was he really doing? How does it hang together? And how does it hang together between Dallas and New Orleans? Because we so often consider those to be independent. And what I'm seeing more and more is that Oswald started off on a personal agenda in the spring of 1963 that carried him up to the time of the assassination. Had nothing to do with the assassination per se, but that he was following an agenda that we see emerge in Dallas and mm-hmm. and extend into New Orleans. And you can't, I don't think we have separated the two just because of how we approach things. I remember when the Garrison investigation was occurring, hearing about it on the news and going, why in the world? What does New Orleans have to do with shooting the president in Dallas?
Yeah.
Well, it may have had a great deal to do with it, and we need to look at the whole package. And I think this is meticulous research on Greg's part. That's the kind of work he does. And we need detail. We need to, like I said, break out of our boxes a little bit and look at the detail that we have now and not get stuck in these themes that we've just been repeating for the past 30 to 60 years.
Absolutely, and I am all for that. So everybody, you can go to larry-hancock.com. Again, the link will be with the show notes. Greg, is there a particular place you'd like people to visit to take a look at your work, or should we do this one article at a time with you?
Well, I mean, anyone that wants to can check my website, which is www.scrollery.com.
Okay.
And there I have several JFK assassination papers and, you know, hopefully they have more to come.
Well, look, I want to discuss some other stuff with you in the near future and really appreciate the fact that you've given us a fresh look at a very old subject and a often ignored part of that subject. So, again, I want to thank Mike Swanson for being with me in the first hour, as always, and also Larry Hancock. Both of you guys, great. Love to have you both on the same Thursday. But if not, it's okay. We can get by with one of you or the other for sure. And Greg, welcome to the mix here. I don't know if everybody's going to be happy with you. And I'm sure I'm going to get some hate mail from some people who have some established views in the case. But I welcome all feedback, info@ocelli.com or blindjfkresearcher@gmail.com. Either way, I will fully accept your hate mail. And I'm going to examine some more of Mr. Dudna's work here Wow, did I pronounce it correctly that time, Greg?
that's no problem. Don't worry. It's Doudna, but don't worry
Doudna,
about it.
Doudna. I will get it. I assure you. Maybe 3-4 shows from now I'll get it, okay? But I'm going to do my best. Greg Doudna. There we go. Take a look at his website. Once again, Scholery. I know I have it bookmarked here.
Scholery.
Scholery. Yes. Okay. So it's S-C-O-L-L-E-R-Y, right?
S-C-R-O-L-L-E-R-Y.
Scholery.
Right?
Okay. Scholery. All right. Anyway, the link will be there with the show notes. And as always, Larry Hancock, and I'll also throw a couple of books, a couple of links to Larry's books. Not all of them, because I don't want the whole page to be dominated by Larry's tremendous, voluminous work, which I recommend all of it. And so far, what I've read of Greg's work, I recommend that as well. Look, even if Greg turns out to not be entirely correct, I think it's worthy of examination. And oddly here, Greg, I got to tell you, I always reserve the right to say, look, I'm not sure until I know for certain and until we have, you know, a whole lot of the preponderance of evidence in hand. I don't make absolute declarations here, but I got to say, this is a really fine piece of work, contains a lot of good information and a lot of reasonable conclusions. So I appreciate that. And I urge you guys to take a look at Greg's work, and we'll try and take a look in future shows at his work as well. Whether I can get him back as a guest or not, we'll continue to look at his work, and hopefully you'll come back again, Greg.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chuck, for having me, and thank you, Larry.
Absolutely. Larry Hancock again, larry-hancock.com. Go there, check out his blog. Always buy any of his books. If you don't have one of them, get another one, whichever one. Someone Would Have Talked pertains to the case, but then again, all of Larry's work, I absolutely endorse it, whether it's Unidentified, Creating Chaos, Surprise Attack. I don't have time to name it all. But remember this, guys. I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.